Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special guest tonight is Dennis Cyprus, staff cartoonist since 1998 at The New Yorker, where he's published nearly 700 cartoons, and we're talking about his new book, What's So Funny? A Cartoonist's Memoir. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
David, how would you intone What's So Funny? I was giving it all these different readings.
Well, one curious thing is that people who have tried to read parts of it out loud tend to, for one thing, give my father an accent. He definitely did not have an accent, so that's the first crucial thing, because part of his whole assimilation quest was to lose his accent. Other than that, I like to be read without anybody hamming it up, you know, and trying to make it funnier than it is, but just let the words do the job.
Okay. Done. Now, this is not your autobiography. You're a lifelong New York City dweller, and this is most definitely a book about family and how family affects who we are and who we become. Describe your family for me. Let's person by person. Let's start with Nathan.
My father, Nathan, was an immigrant who came as an 8-year-old in 1914, just before the First World War, with his mother and four siblings. And the family settled in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And my father went on to sort of escape that past and become a businessman, an entrepreneur, and had a jewelry store, which was enormously successful. And he was a man who had a lot of secrets about the past that he was not at all interested in going into with me, his son, who was dying to know the story behind the story.
There seemed to be several times in the book where he would take you aside and go, "We have to talk." And your reaction was, "Oh my God."
Those talks usually amounted to nothing,
though. That's right. There's all this anticipation, and then there was always the mystery still remained.
Yeah. Well, one time he took me aside to try to tell me about the birds and the bees, and that conversation lasted about 10 seconds. I said, "I know all that already," and that was that.
What I love about, among many things about your father, is that he would use these sort of aphorisms, these sayings all the time that are really well-known and well-worn, like clothes make the man.
Yeah.
And he just seemed to come out with them all the time, but he lived by them.
Yeah, he did. And that one in particular, my father's dedication to dressing well was a lifelong obsession with him. I think what's interesting is that he did pepper his conversation always with those aphorisms, which, again, I think was an indication of his desire to assimilate, to become a real American, real American. Yeah.
I started to write them all down, and then it was just too long a list. When you're talking about this high-end jewelry shop that he ran, stars would come in and buy jewelry there. You actually had sort of an idealistic childhood in some ways. You got to meet all these famous people.
Yes. My father's store was a magnet for celebrities, the highlight of all being when the day that Marilyn Monroe
kissed
my cheek. That's really something. But Mrs. Kennedy came in often. Lots of other stars of the 50s and 60s. That sort of impressed me. At the same time, I was never liked to observe my father kind of acting deferential to these
people.
Right.
That's right.
So that caused me some shame and embarrassment, too.
Didn't some of them consistently call him by the wrong name?
Yes, the store, he called the store Revere Jewelers,
right,
because it was on Lexington Avenue and Paul Revere and all that. And these high-end WASP customers would come in, and many of them didn't know his real name and called him Mr. Revere. And what was astounding to me, and again, a little embarrassing, was that he never corrected them.
Yeah.
He liked being taken for who he wasn't. So, yeah.
That's because the customer is always right.
Yes, that was one of his main tenets by which he lived. Absolutely.
And he was a snappy dresser.
Yeah, he was. That presenting that kind of an image to the world was another part of the really important aspect of assimilation. And I think that, and also he just, for some reason, although he never had an education beyond the fifth grade, he seemed to have an innate talent for an eye for what good taste, for both in the jewelry in his shop, but also in the clothes that he bought and the art that he collected. In every way, he had a sense of taste that is surprising and
right.
to come out of nowhere, and that really expressed itself in his beautiful suits and sulca and ties and everything about the way he presented himself to the world.
But that ended up affecting the way you thought about precious objects.
Yeah, I mean, well, for a long time, my father's obsession with those things represented everything I tried to reject. I mean, I went through a serious hippie phase. I never cared that much about my outfits. But in the end, I've come to realize that I inherited that love of beautiful things that my father had. In my case,
that's right.
I have a little modest collection of art that means the world to me. And when I come home at night and sit down, I love to look at it, and just the way my father loved to look at his beautiful things.
Let's talk about your mother, Estelle Cypress. I always felt bad for your mother throughout the book, especially as she started developing these migraines. But her life was to make things easier for Nathan.
Yes, that making life easy for him, helping him avoid any upset of any kind, was really her life's work. Before she married my father, she had a much freer kind of existence. But once she married him, she became the good soldier and really, for most of her life, dedicated herself to keeping him from experiencing any upset of any kind, which, of course, is impossible. But she did her best. And what's interesting about my mother was that when she got to be really old and began to lose her memory, she turned back to that girl, a little that she was before she met my father. She became mischievous, rebellious, and that just made me love her more.
And that's one of the really poignant things about this book, is watching your parents age through your eyes. Your father and your mother both become really interesting, but not necessarily happy people as they got older. But still, your father, I could almost say to his dying day, man, waitstaff better look out for your father. There are some stories in this book that are cinematic, that are literally, I saw these events unfolding before me as I read them.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And yes, you're right. He had very little patience with people that served him and waited on him and his tailor or waitresses. And I think that in some ways, if I think about it, he needed to exert the kind of power over them that was exerted over him.
That's
by
right.
his customers. I think there was a kind of transference there that went on. And it also goes back to what you mentioned a minute ago. The customer is always right. He felt completely empowered when
That's
he
right.
was being served.
He was on the other side. He was on the other side from his jewelry store, and he was going to make the most of it.
Yes. My favorite was that we used to go to this delicatessen, which I described in the book,
oh, God.
Where there was a particular waitress, and he only went there so he could fight with her. And she couldn't wait for him to get there so that they could get into it.
Man, that was an amazing piece of writing right there. Oh, my God. And now, and then finally, there's your sister, Linda. And throughout the book, she's sort of a bit of a wild card. Like, you can't quite figure out what's going on with your sister. She's older. She gave you a lot of crap as a younger brother, as older sisters would. But her story ends up being really tragic and sad. And I don't want to give away a lot in the book because people really need to read it. But your sister is a really interesting person, and it's just sad what happened.
Yeah, she was obviously very smart. A very smart person, but got in her own way over and over again. Her dependence on my father was very, very harmful in the end to her. We see each other in our siblings. I see a lot of sides of my sister and me, but I was always fortunate in that I had a sense of humor about myself and about life, and being a creative person, I had that outlet to overcome some of those things that trapped her and ultimately kind of ruined her life.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Cypress, right?
Correct.
Thank you. Staff cartoonist since 1998 at The New Yorker, where he's published nearly 700 cartoons, and we're talking about his new book. It's a really, really, sort of one of those reads you just sort of get into, and I just go right to the end of the book. What's so funny? A cartoonist's memoir. Now, I have to mention, this memoir is profusely peppered with your artwork, with a few other examples. The use of your cartoons in this book is wild. Were some of these specifically created for this book?
Very few of them, only about two or three. I mean,
I find that so hard to believe because they are so apt.
Well, what I discovered about myself as I wrote the book was that there was basically nothing in my life I've seen, heard, experienced that at some point I haven't made a cartoon about.
No kidding.
So I'd be writing about something and I think, oh yeah, I did that one about parents sacrificing everything and then their kid quitting school. I did that one, and I would just kept popping them in. And I realized that was a way I could write this book.
Oh my God.
They became really useful to me as a writer because, the way I express myself, the most important thing to me as a creative person is, in a lot of ways, my humor.
Right.
And a lot of the stuff in the book, like many families, my family had some really bad stuff that happened. And I was always thinking, how can I write about that and not lose the tone of the book, not be not myself, the person who tries to be humorous? And the cartoons really provided me with an answer to that. I could pop them in whenever an anecdote or a story needed that little salutary punch of humor.
Wow.
And after a while, it just became the way the book turned out.
It's like a Greek chorus, except it's you.
It's just me, though.
But it's an aspect of you. It's your cartoonist. It's the cartoonist, David. But it's amazing, the commentary, and it works perfectly within the this book ends with a cartoon, which sums it up perfectly too. Now, I want to talk about that, one of the things this book traces is your evolution to finally coming to the terms that you wanted to do what you always wanted to do. And early on, you had discovered that drawing plus funny equals cartoons, and you, from a very young age, drew as a way of understanding events.
Absolutely. And at first, it was almost, I discovered it almost a physical thing. Like whenever I was anxious or afraid or worried, if I had a drawing implement in my hand and I touched it to a page, it's like everything in my body would calm down. And that continues till today. But more than that, this creative outlet, this coming up with cartoons and drawing them, has really given me a way to navigate everything that's gone, that happens in my life, and especially has been helpful with all the stuff that's been difficult.
And as with many people that I've talked with who are artists, it's never a happy decision that you decide to become a cartoonist for your family.
It certainly was not a happy decision from my father, that's for sure.
Oh my God. And you tried to make a go of the alternative, some parallel universe. There's a David Cypress who is a Russian scholar. You tried to do it. And then you had a really fateful day. It was amazing. You were at Harvard. You spent some time in Cambridge. And it was in the psychedelic era. You were studying Russian literature, and you had this interesting interaction with this professor about what you thought should have been taught. This professor was wild. First of all, first thing he said in the class is no questions.
Yeah, which in a way paralleled my father, who also refused to answer questions. I was not expecting to study with him. He was a substitute for the professor I was longing to study with about the Russian Revolution. And what he did was the thing that precipitated my dropping out of school for good. Again, I don't know how much of that story to
tell. Well, let's talk about it. We'll talk about some sample stories. First of all, so nobody asked questions for the entire semester. And then there was this thing where a bunch of you get together and you go, we got to ask him one question. And you ended up being the person. You were the person chosen to ask the question.
Well, we went to a venerable Chinese restaurant in Harvard Square and we cut cards and drew a card. And I can still see, as I say in the book, the three of clubs that won me the job. And so I insisted at the last class in asking him a question. I didn't really even think about what the question would be till I stood up. And I nervously asked him a question about anti-Semitism. And he turned around and wrote three books on the board and said, if you're so interested in anti-Semitism, Mr. Cypress, read these books. And so, of course, I didn't. I just studied everything else for my final exam. And I sat in the auditorium ready for my final, and I see him coming towards me smiling, which was really scary because I'd never seen a man smile before. And with a big grin, he slapped a test down on my desk and said, Mr. Cypress, you're so interested in the question of anti-Semitism. I've given you an entire examination on that subject. And that was it for me. I felt my fingers go dizzy, and I felt dizzy, and I just said, that's it, I'm out of here. And that was the day I quit graduate school. And never looked back.
I don't blame you, frankly.
It was a horrible thing for him to do.
What an ass. What a colossal ass.
But, you know, it was good for me. I needed something to push me out of there because, as I say in the book, I really felt like I was trapped in the wrong life. It was really my father's fantasy I was living out. Always been to be an artist, to be a cartoonist.
But if that was difficult, the conversation with your father, which we won't get into, when I saw that coming, I went, oh my God, that's going to be it. And it was the first time your father swore in the book.
Yeah, and the only time he ever swore that I've ever heard.
Oh my God.
It was pretty devastating. And I don't really, maybe I shouldn't say what happened.
Don't. Let's say, we got to leave surprises for the for people
that was,
to.
That was in some ways the hardest day of my life up to that point. Yeah.
The interesting thing for me growing up, I grew up outside of Boston and Cambridge and Watertown, is that you spent some time with the Boston After Dark, Boston Phoenix newspaper as their cartoonist.
Some time is over 30 years. So
I know.
A lot of time. Yeah. That was my first break, actually, was I was discovered by the Boston Phoenix. Well, what was Boston After Dark and then Boston Phoenix. And I remained in there every week for over 30 years. I learned so much about myself and my work from doing that, from that weekly slot. At the same time, it was 25 years of frustration because where I really wanted to be was the New Yorker.
Of course, of course.
Not so much Boston After Dark or Boston Phoenix.
Now, I got to talk to you because you have some of the examples of your older cartoons in the book and then your recent cartoons, which are instantly visually recognizable as yours. I mean, there is a David Cypress style.
Yeah.
But how did you transition? Because when I look at your older comics, they remind me of things that I did at that age, too. I'm not talking content. I'm talking about actual visual style. How did you develop that sort of nervous line that you're renowned for?
Well, the first thing is I never went to art school. I never had any formal training. And from the very beginning, what I loved about cartoons, even as a kid, was that they looked sort of easy to do to me. Huh. All I had to do was sit down and draw, and I could make a cartoon. And so, even at an early age, I really liked the idea that my drawing looked spontaneous, like I didn't suffer over it or work too hard over it. And that carried through all the way up till today. I really like the reader to think, oh, he thought the cartoon up, he drew it. other people do beautiful drawings with intricate washes, and I just like this direct approach. And also, even back then, in the Phoenix, I was already using the tool that really makes all this possible. I draw with a crow quill pen.
When I read that, because I've used it, I couldn't believe it. The crow quill is like going back to the medieval period.
Well, what I love about it, as I say in the book, is that it's really hard to control.
That's right. So it is.
You make mistakes. You make lines you didn't intend to. But that, for me, was all part of the charm of drawing that way. I wanted to look direct and spontaneous, and the pen and the happy accidents it creates when it slips a little in the hand.
Yep.
It's all part of the style that I really have always wanted to do.
You call it straggly surprises.
Yeah.
It makes total sense now. But you never went through a rapidograph phase?
I tried it, but I was just bored with this sort of unchanging, immutable line that it made. I wanted that line to surprise me. And I feel like if it surprises me, and it's not just the line, but the ideas, everything about a cartoon, if it surprises me as a cartoonist, then I know it's going to surprise the reader. And surprise is a crucial element of the cartoon, getting the reader to open their eyes and say, wow, I never thought of that. So,
now, am I to understand in some cases the drawing comes first and the caption later?
People ask that a lot, and for me, the answer is pretty complicated. There are many of my cartoons that began with a drawing, and I describe some in the book.
You just think that the drawing itself is going to lend itself to an interesting caption.
Yeah, some I've looked at for days, even weeks before the caption popped into my head. But you just get the feeling about a drawing that there's a cartoon in there. But other times, a lot of my life I spend, I call it my cartoon brain. And in every situation I'm in my life, there's a little part of me that's looking, waiting to hear something that might work for a cartoon. And then, so that way, the cartoon begins with words or conversations. And then there's the main way they come, which is I just sit there at my desk and open my mind to the cartoon gods and see what floats in there. and it's a kind of meditation.
Yep.
I've been doing it for 50 years, and you have good days and bad days, but most of the time some good stuff sinks into my brain.
Your father never drew except for one thing that you found after his passing.
Well, actually, he did draw. Back in the day, he kept an inventory in his store.
That's right.
And he drew every single object, piece of jewelry that ever...
On these little cards.
...bought and sold on little index cards.
Yeah.
But there's this really incredibly moving moment when, after he died, I was going through this file cabinet where all his drawings of the jewelry were. And I pulled out a card, and I turned it over, and there was this drawing my father had done, this beautiful pencil drawing of a dog, of the head of a dog. I realized he was probably sitting in his window at 61st Street doing something else, saw a dog and drew it. And for some reason, more than anything else after my father's death, that's what really moved me. I guess it was I sensed a connection between the two of us.
Yeah, yeah.
Through drawing. Yeah.
We're almost out of time, but I want to talk about your wife, Jenny, because she's got a really interesting role in this book. Maybe it's me, but she sounds like the voice of reason all the time. Is she?
Well, she's standing right here, so I'll
tell her that she's wow. She's really put up with a lot, and she's come through, and she's the sensible one.
Yes, and you know what I also tried to emphasize in the book? You said my father had aphorisms. I love some of Ginny's Southernisms that I use a lot in the book. But yes, I don't think I could have gotten through any of this without my wife's wise take on everything. She really was the person who explained my family to me in a way that I couldn't explain it to myself.
You really needed an outside observer to sort of bring you through that. And through some really critical periods in the book, too, she was the person that sort of brought you around.
Yeah. You need that. You need a relationship like that in your life.
Oh, my God. Did you luck out?
Yes.
Now, there are some pieces that I would love to talk about, but we're not. But one of the things, and I don't know why I identified this, there's a piece early on about you as a wee child throwing your toys out the window.
Yeah.
And we're not going to give away all the details of it, but that is one of the I want to see a movie made out of that that whole thing, because there's something weird about things that kids do without like really following through on what the consequences are that memory captures.
Yeah, you know, the thing about when you live on the 12th floor, you can't see the consequences. All you see is a toy flying out the window. So you really can't. And I'll tell you something funny. I've gotten a lot of emails and letters from people who grew up in New York around the time I did it, lived on an upper floor. And all of them seem to at some point have tossed something out the window.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is David Cypress, staff cartoonist since 1998 at The New Yorker, where he's published nearly 700 cartoons. He was also at the Boston Phoenix for decades. And we're talking about his new book. I cannot recommend it enough. It's a wonderful read. What's So Funny? A Cartoonist's Memoir. David, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate it.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.